late 80s and early 90s, the crack epidemic was in full swing in many parts of the country, including Lorain, Ohio, where Sunset Boulevard was known as the place to buy and smoke crack without being hassled by the authorities. The infamously corrupt Lorain Police Department had a relationship with a drug dealer, addict, and notorious informant named William Avery Sr., who ran the scene on Sunset Boulevard, and he didn't appreciate New Yorkers encroaching on his turf. On August 8, 1991, the bodies of two local drug users, Marsha Blakely and Floyd Epps, were discovered separately. The tire marks on their heads were at least in part to blame for their deaths. After the cases went cold, a $2,000 reward drew the attention of William Avery Sr., who brought in his teenage son to falsely accuse four men from New York, including Al Cleveland. The fact that Al Cleveland was in New York at the time of the murder and that Avery Jr. recanted his statement at the first of the four trials did not stop prosecutor Jonathan Rosenbaum from going ahead with all four of these sham trials. The Ohio criminal legal system continuously ignored William Avery Jr.'s recantations for 25 long years, leaving parole as Al Cleveland's only avenue for relief. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me. And today, you're going to hear a story that defies description. I'm going to, first of all, introduce first Jennifer Passion Bergeron, who's been on the show before, is the deputy director of the Ohio Innocence Project. Jennifer, welcome back to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And Al Cleveland.
Yes.
Al, I'm just going to say this. Al has lived about seven or eight lifetimes so far. And he survived 25 years in prison for a gruesome double murder that happened in Ohio while he was in Queens, New York. That's just the beginning. So without further ado, Al Cleveland, I'm so happy you're here. I'm sorry you have to be here, but I'm happy you're here.
Hey, I'm here, man. I'm with Jason Flom. You got to realize, Jason, like, I'm fresh home. Like, I've just been home maybe 5 months, and I sat on a rack visualizing this. So here we are, man. I'm excited. I'm pumped up. And thank you for doing this. Thank you for doing this.
I don't even know what to say. That means more to me than you can even know. And so, Al, going back to the beginning, you grew up, such a fascinating story. You were a hip-hop artist.
Yeah.
And not only that, but you were very close friends with LL Cool J back in Hollis, Queens.
Yes, sir.
About that.
Yeah, so he grew up right around the corner from me. So we were always in the basement, you know, making mixtapes and making songs. And like, I seen his ascent from the basement to, you know, a national stage, you know, used to go with him on tour. Like, if he was in any of the surrounding states, we would get in a van and go wherever he was and get backstage passes and, you know, just have tons of fun. It was just tons of fun seeing that rise.
Yeah, you witnessed literally the birth of a legend, and he was your dear friend. I mean, rumor has it that you actually painted his room. I mean, that's so crazy.
I did. And he owes me $30 still for it.
Oh, my God. With interest. That's incredible. In his 1998 book, I Make My Own Rules, LL actually shouts you out and credits your artwork, actually, as an early inspiration of his. So that's one. Okay, that's just one. You ain't heard nothing yet. Stick with us. Okay. So another childhood friend of yours is Damon John. And this, I think, highlights how crazy and random all this shit is, because I think it's fair to say you all had the same potential, but the system grabbed you and those guys went on to become success stories while you were being held captive by the state for a crime you didn't commit. And for those of you who don't know, Damon John is the founder and CEO of FUBU. So tell us about Damon just quickly and how you come to know him in the beginning.
Oh, man, me and Damon, we went to the same Catholic school together in our neighborhood from maybe second or third grade all the way up. We go on adventures, bike rides, camping with my dad. That was my guy, man. I wrote a book about it, actually, a little children's book.
What don't you do? I feel like you... Okay, whatever. We're going to get into that later. So to set the stage, we're back in the 80s and early 90s. The crack epidemic was in full swing, and you were now going back and forth
to Northeast Ohio, right?
Right.
It seems so random. Why would a kid from Queens end up in Lorain, Ohio?
All right. So since I'm talking to you, Flam, and you got experience in the music business, I want to just go back a little bit to help you and help everybody understand. So late 80s, my sister gets killed by some skinheads in Detroit. And it was a big thing. My mom was protesting. But me, I internalized this thing and just kind of like went into my art. And at the time, I was doing graffiti and, you know, art on that level, trying to get into galleries and trying to make my way. But it wasn't happening. So I started promoting parties, doing shows, ran into a guy who had a studio. We started going to the studio. I found out, hey, I got some talent. I can rap. I can do this. I seen LL do it. Let me take this route. So we started going to the studio and making songs. And we started forming a vision of what we wanted to do. But the problem was, Jason, back then, you know, you had to get records pressed up. You had to get a song mastered. You had to go through all these steps. And I didn't have the money for that. At every stage, we kept finding ourselves broke. So 90, 91, a friend of mine gets in touch with me. He had left New York to go to Ohio with a few other dudes, and they were into the drug scene, low level, but he was incarcerated, and he asked me to help him with the bond money. At the time, I didn't have it. I only had my rent money. So he enticed me a little more and told me he would double my money. Just come on out, give him a few days, and he would have the money back for me. And at the time, I wanted to explore the music scene out here. I said, you know, what the heck, man? And I did it. And I sent him the money, came out here. That's how I wound up out here. He took me to a project. You know, he's showing me how he does his thing. You know, gave me the little package to hold. Police comes. They chase him, arrest him. I have the little thing. I ditched the little thing. I wound up meeting some guys, went to a guy's house who wound up being the guy who wound up setting us up. But I went to his house. He asked me if I had anything. And I'm like, I kind of do. He asked me if I'm from New York. Do I know my co-defendant? I'm like, yeah, I know him. Yeah. He's like, if you got something, I can sell it. So I went and retrieved the stuff. You start breaking it down with him. I didn't even know the prices. We're haggling. And he takes what he buys from me, goes right out into the street, and he's stopping cars like he's a traffic controller, selling his thing. And maybe an hour and a half later, the whole little bag of stuff I had was gone. I had about $2,200 in my pocket. For the next 30 to 40 days, I just went on a mission to get my startup capital. So, I mean, I know it was wrong, but I had a vision. I had a vision, Jason.
And I can't leave out the fact that when you look at the history of hip hop music, there's so many artists, legendary artists, who grew up the same way you did, some of them from the same area you came from, and ended up in the crack game because that was the option that was available at the time, like you said, to get startup capital or whatever it may be. And just by fate, they didn't get arrested. Yeah. And many people know the names. I mean, because these people they're not secretive about it. When I had Meek Mill on the podcast and I asked him this question, how many people he met in prison that were as talented as he is, and he said he couldn't even count how many.
You know, I've met so many guys in there, Jason, who they're visionaries. You know, they're the breadwinners in their families. And I just want to make it clear. I just want to make sure I share this message that if you do have a dream, if you do have a vision, try to find out how to do a business plan. Try to find out how to go to a bank or ask people, family members, to invest in your dream instead of taking that route and putting yourself at risk to come to the penitentiary, because it's full of guys with dreams that fall through. So I just wanted to share that.
No, I'm glad you did. And Jennifer, I want to talk about the Lorain Police Department, because of course, Lorain, Ohio was where Al was spending his time in those days. And they were known for sexual abuse and brutality, which is sadly a problem that exists to this day in so many different police departments around this country. Can you paint a picture of what was going on back then and there? And what was the deal with their unsavory relationship with this shady character, William Avery Sr.?
Yeah, there was a huge crack problem similar to lots of other areas in the country. The police had people like William Avery Sr., who, at least according to Avery, could kind of do some favors as a CI and then be left alone and do whatever he wanted. So there seemed to be sort of this unofficial arrangement between the cops and some of the people there. So it seemed to me that when folks from New York came in and started sort of messing with that system, it did not go over well with either the residents or the police.
You had just gotten involved in this business, so to speak, Al. Were you aware of what the Lorain Police Department was up to?
No, I wasn't. Actually, I found out years later through our investigation that one of my co-defendants was the one who invited me out here. He was kind of like a target. We actually found a picture with him with a bullseye in their police files. Like, here I am. I just waltzed right into Lorraine. I had no idea.
You're a sitting duck, let's face it. And this part of the story centers around a guy named William Avery Sr., who was a prolific paid informant at the time. And yeah. He received special treatment, as informants do, in exchange for his help. He lived on Sunset Boulevard in Lorain, Ohio, with his son, William Avery Jr., who he had introduced to crack when the kid was just 14 years old. And this had become the sort of neighborhood spot where people would come to smoke crack. And the police looked the other way, of course, because he was helping them out while lying for them on cases, as well as maybe providing accurate information once in a while. I have no idea. And then there was Marcia Blakely.
Well, Marcia Blakely was the murder victim. I mean, she was a young woman who was addicted to crack and other drugs and was known on the streets for turning tricks, selling stolen goods to feed her addiction. She was just a user who, for reasons that I still don't quite understand, ended up brutally murdered in this whole situation.
Yeah, so she and a guy named Floyd Epps turned up dead. And this is, you know, one of the most brutal crimes I've ever heard of. On August 8th, 1991, at 9:18 in the morning, Marcia Blakely's body was discovered in an alley behind the Westgate Shopping Center in Lorain. She had 25 stab wounds, fractured ribs, a broken neck, a slit throat, and torture wounds on her neck and head. And if that wasn't enough, her head had been run over by a car twice. Now, earlier that same day at 1:25 a.m., Floyd Epps' body was found nearby, and his head had also been run over by a car. So this is bizarre, because police believe that the murders were related. Anyone would, of course. I mean, you don't hear stories too often of people being of their heads run over by cars, thankfully. But no arrests were made in the Epps killing, and no arrests have been made to this date, which is a whole separate problem. But when nothing was happening with these cases, the cops offered a $2,000 reward for information. So now we go all the way to over a month later, September 10th, William Avery Sr. said he had information, and they told him that the reward would only be given to someone with firsthand knowledge.
Yeah, so William Avery Sr. takes his son, William Avery Jr., in the next day to meet with the cops to say what, you know, he knew about the crime. But his story, as it was told that day, does not match up to what he eventually said in the trials. And in addition, it was just a bizarre meeting where, you know, the cops are interviewing William Avery Jr. about supposedly witnessing this murder. And yet his father sat in on the entire interview and said, like, yeah, I'm here to remind him of the things that he forgot, which just raised all kinds of red flags. But yet that's what they went with.
So when Avery Sr. and Jr. went to the police, Jr. implicated four individuals in the death of Marcia Blakely. The four men were Lenworth Edwards, Benson Davis, John Edwards, and Alfred Cleveland, men that he claimed were drug dealers from New York. Now, Avery Jr. went on to say that he owed you, Al, money. And in order to pay off the debt, Avery Jr. claimed that Al took him to Epps' apartment where Marcia Blakely was, and that Al told him to assault her. Avery Jr. claimed to refuse because he knew Marcia Blakely. So according to this crazy tale from Avery Jr., the three other men assaulted her for 20 minutes while he and Al watched. Avery continued on that he went back to his apartment after the assault, but said that Al came by after and told him, quote, "We took care of the junkie. We knocked her off."
And things just started rolling from there, although they never really found any other evidence at all implicating these guys. But
yeah, they can't find stuff that doesn't exist because they weren't
exactly
there.
Absolutely.
So you weren't even in fucking Ohio, right? What? Tell us where you were during this week and how we know that that's really true.
All right. So yeah, I was on probation at the time. I didn't realize when I was going to trial, I wasn't sure because it was like 4 years later that was the day that I went to my probation officer. But I knew I went back to New York to see my probation officer, and I was in New York with Damon John, who had a van business at the time. I went to buy a TV, and I needed him to come bring the TV to my house. And this is all, you know, the 7th, the 8th, when these people were killed. And when I was going to trial, I had the receipt for this TV. You know, we got those times. You know, he came to trial and prosecutor tried to dog him out like he was some young punk. You know, he tried to discredit him, and it was crazy.
I mean, the state acknowledged that he had seen the probation officer in New York on August 7th, but they just said, well, he must have decided he was going to either drive or fly to Ohio to come and commit this brutal murder against this woman he didn't even know. But it was just the word of one person. That was it.
So four people were victims of this compromised, to say the least, paid informant. And there was a $2,000 reward, and then they paid him again.
Yeah, he got the $2,000 reward for coming forward initially, which was interesting because the award was listed for anyone would get it leading to an arrest. They arrest Linworth Edwards, one of the co-defendants. So he gets the $2,000. They then schedule a deposition of William Avery Jr., claiming that his life is in danger or something. And he gets paid again, and then he ends up getting paid more. So at the end of the whole saga, he ended up getting paid around $5,000 for his testimony.
Right, and we're talking $5,000 is a lot more money than it is today, yeah.
Absolutely. To someone who was a crack addict who, you know, on the stand said he never really had a job, so this was his income.
So Avery Jr. changed and recanted his story multiple times after the initial interrogation, but his claims anyway were enough, and the authorities were happy to use them to convict four men. Avery Jr. was supposed to testify in the first trial because guys were tried separately, right? Linworth Edwards was the first trial.
Yes. So at Linworth Edwards' first trial, this was the first of the four to be tried. Yeah, William Avery Jr. basically demanded $10,000 to keep giving his testimony, which, you know, of course, the prosecutor said, well, no, we're not paying you anything. So at this point, Avery Jr. then says, well, I'm not going to testify. Everything I said before was a lie. So, yeah, they end up throwing him in jail and charging him with contempt. But he later comes back in the second trial for Linworth and says, well, the reason I flip-flopped before was because I was threatened in the jail if I went forward with telling what I know about this crime. And so that's how they got away with putting on his testimony in Linworth's second trial and then in the rest of the defendants' trials. However, what we found out later, years later, was that those threats never happened. We found records showing that Avery Jr., he actually got in trouble for making false reports about getting threatened. And so the whole case was just built on a lie, basically.
A lot of lies, actually.
Yes, several. Yeah. But.
And Al, your trial, you were the third one tried, right? And your trial lasted 6 days.
When the jury came in, I turned around to look at them. And I saw it was hatred, bro. I saw a hatred. And my mom was there. A couple of supporters. And when the judge read the verdict, he told me that I'm sentenced to life. And I told him I didn't do it. And damn it. The screech, when he said guilty, the screech that came from my mother's voice. I knew it took a part. He yanked a serious part from her. And all I could do is try to turn around and comfort her. Like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right.
This episode is underwritten by the AIG Pro Bono Program. AIG is a leading global insurance company, and for over a decade, the AIG Pro Bono Program has provided thousands of hours of free legal services and other support to nonprofit organizations and individuals most in need. More recently, the program added criminal and social justice reform as a key pillar of its mission.
Yeah, so I went to a high security prison. They call them close camps, where they send people that, you know, done some of society's worst crimes. They're there. And those first 6 or 7 years, they're kind of blurry to me because I was so focused on fighting and educating myself. I had to totally, like, re-educate myself because everything I had thought I believed turned out to be a lie about the system and everything. You know, I had to learn about myself. You know, I learned about my history, learn about the history of this country, learn about, you know, other people who suffered injustices and tried to understand how these things happened. You know, it wasn't just me. And I started learning, like, man, this is a big problem. So I just got on a mission to better myself and better educate myself so I could learn how to write better, learn how to communicate better, to get support. You know, I had to be able to write people. It's like you're going on a campaign and you just got to learn how to articulate yourself. At the same time, growing spiritually, working out, trying to be an impact on the guys in there, because I started seeing that, you know, a lot of guys weren't educated at all, like no GEDs and a lot of illiteracy. So I put myself in a block where I could tutor guys and just help out in that way. I knew it was other guys that were innocent, and if they were illiterate, they didn't stand a chance. You know, tons of guys in there for stuff they didn't do, but they don't have any support. They don't know how to explain their situation. They don't even really know what happened. They don't really understand the language that was used on them in the courtroom. Like, they're just sitting there trying to fight their way through the everyday life of prison. So I just had to try to be an impact in there. I wasn't going to allow what happened to me to make me bitter, make me angry, because I saw that it directly affects your health. So I had to make my mind up to, you know, understand forgiveness and try to understand that maybe these people made a mistake. Maybe they really thought we did do this, you know. But I find out later on, this is what gets me angry, man, is that they knew it was other people and other suspects. They were on these guys' trail, man. And these are people that we're finding out are the people that committed the crime. And they were on that track, but just wanted us. Just focus on us, man. And went forward with a full story. A preschooler could have poked holes in this guy's story. But they moved forward with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary to me that you and others have found a way to not only find this spiritual grace or whatever you want to call it, but also to overcome, is the best word I could think of, this incredible hardship. This is not even, I can't even find the right word, but it's worth noting that Al was convicted about 5 years after the crime was committed, all the way in 1996. And that same year, there was a motion for a new trial based on an affidavit from Jeremiah Abdullah Charlton. Al, who was he and why was his affidavit significant?
So this was a few years after my conviction. I run into this guy who says he had some information that he's been trying to share and had in fact shared with police. And he was the last person to see Marsha Blakely. At least he alleged he was, you know, put her into the car with two guys to exchange for drugs. I guess he was like pimping, so to speak. And he put her in the car with these guys. So the judge did give us a hearing based on his affidavit. Anytime somebody files an affidavit, you have to come to testify to the truthfulness of the affidavit. But when we get to the hearing, my lawyer wasn't even prepared. Didn't call him, didn't subpoena. And lo and behold, I found out this same prosecutor had indicted her for some stuff in her office, you know, stuff that they were going through, and had her under indictment at the time of that hearing. So she wasn't in her right mind. And the judge denied the hearing based on her unpreparedness. And she was a good attorney. I mean, she fought. She believed in me, but she couldn't go up against these guys, man. They were too influential.
It seems to me that there were any number of times when the state had not just the opportunity, but the obligation to right this wrong. But like it often does, instead, it sort of got under its shell like a turtle and deflected any new information or evidence to protect this wrongful conviction or these four wrongful convictions.
Yeah. Al did his sort of regular direct appeals, which didn't go anywhere. And then later, Avery Jr., you know, the only guy that put him at the scene, he recanted and admitted that he made the whole thing up. What's interesting about that is it took a long time for Al's family to track down Avery Jr. He kind of lived off the grid and it was hard to find him. But once they did and he admitted, you know, that he had lied in this, what we later found out was that that wasn't the first time he recanted. He actually recanted a couple of years before that to an FBI agent in Detroit, just completely out of the blue and on his own. Nobody from the state ever got a hold of Al or any of his attorneys to let him know that. So at that point, there was no evidence left. And the state's admitted that. in filings before that without Avery Jr., there is no case against Al. So this was before Ohio Innocence Project and I got involved with the case, but he went back to state court with this sworn statement and affidavit from Avery Jr. And in the state court, they finally eventually held a hearing where they called him in to testify. Well, they read him his rights on the stand.
They did.
Threatened to prosecute him with perjury in the four different trials if he proceeded to recant on the stand. And he said, well, I'm not going to prison for 30 years. Took the fifth and walked out. Now, the only reasonable conclusion you could draw from that was that he was going to testify that he lied at the trial because he wasn't in any danger if he was going to suddenly say he was telling the truth at the trial, if that makes sense. But in any case, he walks outside and there's an interview with a reporter right afterward where he says, dude's innocent, but I'm not going to prison for it.
Yeah,
his silence spoke volumes.
Well, absolutely. And if they were interested in justice, they would have let him testify. So yeah, then he lost there and then we ended up in federal court, and that's where I kind of came in.
We know how difficult the federal court is. Unfortunately, due to AEDPA, the chances of success in federal court are basically the same as a snowball's chance in hell. But tell us what you did, how you did it, and how the hell you finally managed to bring him home. It's a miracle.
So we filed it in federal court. And the district court had said that we couldn't go forward with the habeas case because there's this statute of limitations of 1 year. And long story short, they said we were too late. So we filed an appeal because there's this exception if you can show that someone is actually innocent. And that's what we did with the recantation from Avery. And then we had evidence from the alibi witnesses and additional alibi witnesses as well. So the state, you know, had poked holes in Al's alibi at trial by saying, well, he could have driven or flown here after the times we knew he was in New York. Well, we had additional witnesses that we found that prove that Al was in New York at the time the crime happened or so close in time to it that unless he could time travel, he could not have possibly gone back to Ohio. So based on those things, we convinced the Sixth Circuit that we had shown that he was actually innocent. That didn't mean that he got to go home. That just meant that we got the right to actually pursue the habeas claims in the district court. So in federal court, you have to make federal constitutional claims. So we were making federal claims of Brady violations where the state had hid evidence and also that they had intentionally put on false evidence from Avery that they knew was false. And also claim like ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failing to find some of these additional alibi witnesses. And then we also made a claim based on actual innocence and said, you know, he has a federal constitutional right to not be in prison if he's actually innocent. Although interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court, even to this day, has not expressly recognized that that's a federal constitutional right to not be in prison if you're innocent. So we had this hearing and then we lost. I mean, I can't even describe how I felt when the notification came in. It came over email and I saw it and I think I just about fell out of my chair. You know, losing the appeals in this case has been, I think, the hardest thing I've had to deal with professionally. It still boggles my mind and infuriates me and saddens me all at the same time. And then because of the weirdness of habeas law, we weren't allowed to appeal directly. We had to ask for permission to appeal. And then the Sixth Circuit, which was the same court that had said we had put forward a case showing that Al was actually innocent, then denied us the right to appeal and said we didn't even have the right to appeal, which I still can't explain that. I don't know how you say, well, it looks like he's actually innocent, then get more evidence supporting that, and then just say, well, never mind, we're not going to hear your claim anymore. But that's what happened.
That's our system, ladies and gentlemen. The Sixth Circuit said, yep, you're innocent, but no, we're not going to give you a new trial. Furthermore, the Supreme Court has said that actual innocence doesn't necessarily provide a basis for relief. I think it was Scalia who made that, those awful statements. And
it was him.
You know, we should all be reviled by this. Like, what are you talking about? Like, what the fuck are you talking about? That actual innocence is not a basis for relief. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Everybody knows this.
That's exactly right.
that's not the way it works here. It's like procedure is more important than justice. It's basically exactly. what it comes down to. And it's yeah. madness. It's absolute madness. And we're here, Al's here in the flesh as a living example of just how wrong all of this is. But before we get to the closing of the show, I want to talk about one other absolutely extraordinary aspect of your life. And that is your wife and family.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's beautiful. In all this darkness and misery, this woman who I look forward to meeting someday stood by you. How is that even possible? 25 years.
We did an interview yesterday and I asked her during the interview, what would make a woman make such a huge sacrifice in her life? And she just said, man, love. I mean, it was very powerful. And this woman loves me, man. Like, that's why I made that song, Jennifer, about you guys. And I'm telling all through the song, like, love can do all things. Yeah, I had Damon John as a friend, and he did rise while I was in prison and helped out with attorney fees where he could and where I needed him to. But it wasn't money. It was the love of people. It was a love of my wife. It was a love of family members who supported me. It was a love of Jennifer and the Innocence Project. And it's just me saying thanks. So I want to share that. You know, I go by the name of Deacon Cleveland. It's called Welcome Back.
And it's awesome.
Thanks for all of them prayers. Thanks for all of your thoughts while I was up in there. Appreciate your support while I was down and banging out in them courts, you know?
Al, I'm so happy that your talents will finally be put to use in the world. So everyone, please make sure you scroll down. We'll have all of this linked in the bio.
And don't forget my wife and our book. She's sitting right here with me. Three Strands, One Cord, A Couple's Guide to Understanding Incarceration. For couples and families going through incarceration, if they need some help on how to navigate that terrain and make it through and possibly even thrive in love.
Yes.
Then get the book. It's our way of serving that community. So Three Strands, One Cord, A Couple's Guide to Understanding Incarceration. Roberta and Alfred Cleveland. Thank you.
For real, man, those at the Ohio Innocence Project, Jennifer and them, and Morgan and Cassie in Virginia, and you know, Jason Flom and Lori, pushing, praying. My wife, my kids, never complain once, move house to house.
In summer of 2020, Jennifer, you presented Al's case of innocence along with countless letters of support. And at that parole board hearing, they voted in favor of Al's release.
So in Ohio, the way it works is if you are recommended for parole and certain crimes, the victim's family or the prosecutor has the opportunity to object. So that's what happened. And so then it goes to the full parole board. So there was 10 members and we went in person. Al was not there. It was me and his wife. We came in and spoke, and then Damon John spoke via the internet. And then, you know, the victim's family members were allowed to speak too, but it was a really moving and overwhelming moment because one of the victim's family members actually spoke out in favor of parole because she didn't think that they had done the crime either, which just hearing that was overwhelming. So the whole parole board left and we just kind of had to sit there and wait for them to make a decision, which was, you know, one of the longest times of waiting I think I've ever felt. But they came back in and it was 9-1 in favor of parole for him, and his co-defendant Lindworth Edwards was also up that day. And so they both were granted it. And I mean, it was just incredible knowing he was finally going to come home. It was frustrating knowing he wasn't getting exonerated or no one was acknowledging his innocence yet, but at least he'd be home.
It's anticlimactic in a sense because, and this is important for the audience to hear, Al still hasn't been declared actually innocent, which means he's not eligible for compensation. He still has to be on parole, et cetera.
Right.
I'm going to put it out there right now. I mean, I think we have to explore the possibility of getting an absolute pardon. You know, I will help in any way that I'm asked to. I don't want to get in the way. I think the governor of Ohio is a reasonable and decent man.
Well, thank you. I will say that we're not done yet. We think we've identified who actually did the crime. And so, you know, we're now in the position, the only legal avenue he has forward at this point is if we can solve the crime for the state and kind of take it to them, which is what we're working on. So stay tuned. Hopefully this isn't the end. Hopefully he will eventually get the exoneration he deserves.
Amen to that. And at this point, we turn to the part where I, first of all, thank each of you for being here and sharing this unbelievable story. And now I'm going to introduce the closing of the show, which is called Closing Arguments, appropriately enough. And this is the part where I turn off my microphone, kick back in my chair, close my eyes, leave my headphones on, and I turn it over to you first, Jennifer, for closing arguments, whatever you want to say, anything you think that's left unsaid, and then we'll save the best for last, and we'll go to you, Al, for your closing arguments, and that's how we'll end the show.
Well, I wanted to say thank you for having me on today and, you know, listening to the story of Al. We barely scratched the surface of all the crazy twists and turns of this case, but I appreciate you bringing this to the audience. And Al, I just wanted to say thank you for, you know, believing in me over this whole time, even when things haven't gone as we hoped. But I'm just so delighted that you're home, and I'm so excited to see all the good that you're doing in the world. And I'm happy that other people now finally get to see what I've been able to see for the last 11 years that we've been working on this case together. And I'm excited to see what comes in your future. But also just a reminder that you can't do it all in a day, because I know you're trying.
Al?
So, Jennifer, I want to thank you. I want to thank Cassie. I want to thank Morgan. I want to thank Virginia. I want to thank Professor Godsey for, you know, backing us, putting you in position, for taking the case, taking a huge burden off of me and my family. You know, thank you. Second, Jason, you talked about going to the governor for a pardon and helping in any way you can. Thank you for that. But I have two co-defendants who are still incarcerated, Benson Davis and John Edwards. And if we went to the governor about anything, I would want the focus to be them and their release, because they're sitting in there. Their poor boy days didn't come up like Lenny's and ours did. They're still in there. And they don't deserve to be there. So any efforts in that area, I would love to be focused on them. I'm going to be all right, bro. I'm going to be okay. You know what I mean? But them. And if anybody out there has any information, you know, what a long shot this is on a Wrongful Conviction podcast. Who knows? Somebody might listen to this and have some information about who really committed the crimes. We think we know the truth. We think we know who did it. But we need confirmation. We need concrete evidence. So please contact my lawyer at the Innocence Project. Jennifer, please tell them your number or who they can contact. If you have any information, contact them and let's get this over with so we can get these men out of prison. Jennifer, please tell them your number.
Yeah, absolutely. The Ohio Innocence Project, you can reach us here at 513-556-0752. And I also wanted to just add that the fact that, you know, you were given the chance to say anything after Jason and your first thought is to think of your two co-defendants who are still in prison, I think tells everybody all they need to know about your character.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Please support your local Innocence Projects and go to the link in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Warnes. The music on the show, as always, is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.